ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
One of the miracles of manufacturing new products today is the use of nanomaterials, substances that are extremely small. Think of a piece of paper you're holding in your hands. Look at the edge of that paper, and then imagine something 100,000 times smaller. That is a nanomaterial. They're found in all kinds of products that we use in our everyday life. Things like sunscreen, the paint that gives our cars a shiny finish, even the clothing that we wear. Now, while the tiny particles have dramatically improved the performance of many products, there is a downside. Scientists are finding that the nanomaterials are often being washed into our lakes and streams. On this edition of UWM Today, we talk to a UW-Milwaukee researcher who's studying the effects of nanomaterials on our environment. Rebecca Clapper is a professor in UWM's School of Freshwater Sciences, and we welcome her back to today's program because, Rebecca, you've been on a number of times before. You're doing such interesting work down at the School of Freshwater Sciences. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me and your interest in my research.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about nanomaterials because when they came out a number of years ago, when scientists discovered how to create these, people said it was going to revolutionize the way that we make things in this world because you have itty-bitty tiny pieces that when you put them together seem to help products move or function better. So they're not all bad, are they?
No. And really, the goal of our research is to help inform, you know, how you can make them in a safe way so that they can be positively used in products. And so, you know, they're being used for, like you mentioned, paints for the coloration in paints and sunscreens to help protect our skin, little tiny titanium dioxide, little tiny zinc oxide nanoparticles. They're being used for medical devices, for sensors, for the environment, and for medicine, where we can miniaturize something and take a sample that is very small and take a measurement, a very small blood sample, a very small water sample, in order to be able to detect things like bacteria or contaminants, metabolites in humans or other organisms. So there are all sorts of positive reasons for these materials. Oh, and water filtration is another use that people are starting to really exploit in a wide variety of types of devices. So taking out pollutants, taking out bacteria and viruses that we don't want in our water when we drink it.
So what are you finding in terms of the potential downside of using these in all of these products?
So like any type of chemical, we have to evaluate their safety. And the research that we've been doing started back when I started as a faculty member back in 2003, where we were looking at, you know, these materials were just starting to come on the market, the first types of nanomaterials. And so the question was, how do you even evaluate their safety to begin with? So the materials are in a particle form, a very tiny particle form. And generally, when we look at chemicals, we're looking at something that gets dissolved in a liquid. And these particles don't. They're floating around in a liquid. And so how do you evaluate something that is more particle-shaped and has particle properties rather than a liquid? And so we look at things like, you know, does it outright kill organisms that we care about, or that are our key indicator organisms for potential environmental impact. And people are doing this also on the human health side as well, kind of analogous to looking at pollutants in the air, the diesel particles that are emitted by trucks, other, you know, dust particles and pollution particles in the air that we breathe. So it's kind of evolved on two fronts, where we're looking at human health effects and then in our lab looking at potential environmental effects of these things.
Do the nanomaterials ever break down, or do they always stay these tiny, tiny little microscopic pieces or specks that that remain in that same state after they're no longer needed in the product?
That's a really good question, and it's one that people grappled with as we started progressing in the research. We saw that these things change over time. So you might have something that starts out in a very small nano-sized particle, so something that's smaller than a red blood cell, and then it might in the environment aggregate with some of the organic matter, other things that are in the environment, dirt particles and things that are in water systems. They can also, depending on the material, because we're not talking about just one type of chemical here. There are metal oxides, there are pure metals, there are carbon-based particles. So it just really depends on the chemistry of the particle as to what happens to it. What is its fate in the environment? So some of the metal oxides, for example, break down. So zinc oxide breaks down into zinc ions in the environment, which can be toxic depending on the concentration. Other things aggregate and make bigger particles that are maybe not so toxic. And so it really depends. And it's been a question that has persisted over the time that we started studying this up until now. People are still trying to investigate, what do these things look like eventually when they're out in the environment and over time? How do they change? How do they transform?
And that's really the key. It's over time, because if the material is just introduced to the environment, and you say 2001, 2003 is when these things came on the market, that's a relatively short amount of time when you consider how long it takes to understand the impact of something like this being introduced into our environment.
Yeah, that's true. And that's scientists grapple with that all the time. You know, how a lot of the assays that we do to determine toxicity are on a short time frame. And so how do we predict something that happens over a much longer time frame? One example is asbestos, which is a particle type that it took, you know, decades for us to figure out that that was a cancer-causing material. And we put it in all sorts of products. It's very beneficial for heat protection and insulation.
It was a miracle product, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the whole goal in the nanomaterial community is to not have another asbestos or not have another PCB going out in the environment. Again, that's kind of the goal of my lab, is to look and see how can you evaluate these chemicals and make predictions of what might be a safer way to create a nanomaterial. And we're working directly with chemists in our Center for Sustainable Nanotechnology, which is an aggregate of a bunch of universities around the country, a project funded by the National Science Foundation and the Chemistry Directorate, really chemists trying to solve this problem. How can you make a nanomaterial in a safe way?
So let's talk about your research. You're using fish to study the impact of nanomaterials in the environment. How are you doing that?
So we use fish and Daphnia, which are a little crustacean, so kind of like a little tiny shrimp. They call them water fleas. And then also a sediment-dwelling organism, an organism that lives down in the muck at the bottom of lakes, to look at different places that organisms live and different types of organisms to see what ends up being toxic. So we look at things like survival, growth, reproduction, but then also some of the metabolism that goes on in the organism in the form of gene expression and some of the stress metabolites that happen when an organism is stressed out and comes in contact with something that's not so great for it.
So do you take the nanomaterials or some solution of them and introduce them into the water that these little creatures are in, or do you inject them somehow?
We do a water exposure, trying to approximate what might happen in the environment. Let's say if it's washed off of a farm field, for instance, some of these nanomaterials are being used in agriculture and might be a great benefit to agriculture. I have one student that's looking at a metal oxide nanomaterial that's being used as an antifungal compound or a potential antifungal compound for a few different types of crop plants. And the idea is that if you use this nanomaterial, it might be beneficial because you wouldn't have to use as much of the fungicide, and it would have a more direct impact on where you're targeting as opposed to having to spray it everywhere. But anyways, we look at, you know, that washing into water systems. And so we do a water exposure. We put a certain kind of a dose response. So we look at very low doses all the way up to a little bit above what we might consider to be environmentally relevant, what we anticipate what might be out in the environment based on what we see with other chemicals and also what people have found with certain nanomaterial types. And we look at that whole range of doses and look and see how the organism survives, how it behaves, what kind of physiological changes happen in the organism.
How far along are you in getting some results, or do you already know what impact these might be having.
Yeah. So our lab, as well as many other labs around the world, have been studying this nanomaterial potential impacts on the environment for a couple decades now, and since 2003. And some of the things that we find is that the toxicity of the nanomaterial really depends on how the organism is exposed, including humans, and also what type of chemistry the nanomaterial has. And that speaks to, our goal of, can you use chemistry to really modify what the nanomaterial, its shape and its surface chemistry, in order to alter how it interacts with the cells of an organism, and then thereby make it safer by changing the design of it in some way so that it doesn't have unintended effects. What we do find is that some materials look like they're really not very toxic at all, and they don't really have very many unintended effects. If they are, they're very minimal. And then other ones we have a little bit more concern about, and those are the ones that we're trying to modify.
If I'm using a sunscreen, should I be concerned that the nanomaterials are getting into my system, into my bloodstream?
There's a research paper that came out recently, and I believe part of it was sponsored by the Food and Drug Administration or the Centers for Disease Control, where they were looking at sunscreens in particular. And, sunscreens can be made from a chemical protectant as well as a more mineral or particle protectant. And they found that the chemical protectant ends up getting really absorbed into your skin and goes into the bloodstream at a higher concentration than they thought. And so they're recommending that if people are sensitive to those chemicals or feel like something is going on, because they don't have data yet on how those chemicals impact people because they were approved before the testing regimes happened. And it's been considered a cosmetic. People didn't think it got absorbed. Now they're recommending that people move to more mineral sunscreens. And so those nanoparticle sunscreens might actually be more favorable in that case.
Wow. Wow. I feel like I'm the subject of a science experiment. Yes. After all these years of counseling my kids and myself to put on the sunscreen, not knowing that there may be some unintended consequences. Yeah. Or results from using it.
And I should say that the results that came out are just on the concentration that they find in people's bloodstreams. It doesn't indicate that there's an effect of that on people. And so we don't know yet. Just because we detect chemicals everywhere, because we're using them all the time, doesn't necessarily mean there's a negative impact by the chemical. It means that we need to study that to figure that out. And, we also know that skin cancer is very dangerous. And so thought is that it's better to be using these products and protect yourself from skin cancer than what we might have seen from the chemical use itself.
So I don't know if it's comforting, but somehow that expression, pick your poison, comes to mind.
Yeah,
as
it kind of does.
As you think about the choices that you have here.
That's true.
When manufacturers created nanomaterials, when scientists first engineered this, did anybody foresee the possibility that there would be a downside, or did they just see a pot of gold at the end of this invention?
The great thing that happened when there was this nanotechnology initiative, and in fact, there's a coordinating office, NNCO, the National Nanotechnology Coordination Office, that coordinates the research projects around nanotechnology in the United States anyway. And when this initiative was developed, many years ago, there was a pot of money set aside for environmental and human health effects and potential policy implications of the use of these materials, which is unlike any other type of class of chemicals that we've had up until this point. And I think it was partly a spawn off of what was also done during the Human Genome Initiative, where they said, we need to set aside something to consider the implications of the research that we're doing. And so this initiative had the same kind of thing, and that's what's funded most of my research, is that part of the initiative where they said, well, in order to really figure out if those are going to be harmful, we really need to have an initiative, part of this initiative, set aside so that we can figure that out.
How have the companies responded to this type of research that you and colleagues around the country are doing? Have they been resistant at all, or do they see the positive benefits of determining what impact that product that they're creating might have on people?
Overall, I think, companies don't want to create an unsafe product and don't want to be hit with, liabilities from these materials. And so they've been seeking from scientists. I've interacted with several different companies within in advisory boards for the government where they ask scientists from companies, from nonprofits, from academia to come together and talk about these issues and advise groups like the Environmental Protection Agency, for example, on the use of these materials. And the companies overall want to know, what do we need to do to provide adequate testing to make sure that our products are safe? And they want to know which nanomaterials might end up causing some kind of harm down the line so that they don't use them in their products. So I think that the research overall has been received favorably because they want to know that information. The fact that the government is invested in figuring that information out is very helpful. Overall, they really want to know a testing scheme so they know definitively that, you know, you're not going to add 10 more tests in the future, that you have this battery of tests that will tell them is something going to be safe so that they can make their materials and then figure that out.
And no, as you mentioned before, nobody wants another asbestos debacle where you are using a material that everybody thinks is a miracle product, but it ends up having serious, serious side effects.
Exactly. Yeah. And one of the great things too is that the nanomaterial world has developed as a bunch of startup companies. So a lot of them came from academic labs that spawned off into companies. And so and then some of it has been integrated into larger companies, of course. But the small companies have been really interactive in these government groups, saying, we're the little guy and we're trying to make these novel things. They've been very interactive on the toxicology side, trying to figure out how to best use the product in a way that would be safe. And so it's been an unusual development, I think, of industries around this technology.
That's good to hear. You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us. I'm Tom Lujak. Joining us in the studio is Rebecca Clapper. She's a professor at UWM School of Freshwater Sciences. And we've been talking about her research in the use of nanomaterials and the impact that those materials, very, very tiny little particles used in the manufacturing process of so many products, what impact that might have on our environment. Rebecca, in addition to the work that you're doing on the nanomaterials side, you also direct the UWM Genetics Lab down at the School of Freshwater Science. Let's talk about that work and whether or not the Genetics Lab has allowed you to do better research on these nanomaterials.
Yeah. So one of the things that was created along with the school about 5-6 years ago was this Great Lakes Genomics Center, where we use genetic and genomic tools to look at all sorts of things. So not only related to the nanomaterials, but the goal of the center is to use genetics and genomics, much like we've used them in the Human Genome Project, to look at how humans are how healthy a human is and what kinds of genetic makeups within a human might dictate how they respond to environmental insult, how each of us differs in our response to things in the environment. And so we're trying to create an analogous thing on the environmental side. So using these tools in environmental types of questions. So in organisms that we find in the environment, trying to even detect organisms in the environment that we can't see, things like bacteria, viruses, and using these tools to do that. And so in my lab, what we've been doing is using these genomic tools to look at the Daphnia and the fish and the little chironomids, the flies that live in the muck in the bottom of the lake that are a food resource for fish. And using the genomic tools to look at how genes are expressed within these organisms. So everybody has genes within their DNA, but not all of them are what we say turned on or at the same time. So there are certain genes that are turned on when certain processes need to happen in your cells, or even between a liver and your tongue, let's say. The cells in each different part of your body do different things. And so there are certain functions that are unique to different organs within your body. And so we look at which genes are turned on and which genes are turned off in relationship to environmental insults like the exposure to these nanomaterials. And from that information, from this huge amount of data that you get back of thousands of genes that are turned on or turned off, we try to look for patterns to see if there are certain genes that are always turned on when an organism is sickly, so is not growing well, is dying, is looking stressed, is not reproducing right, and use those genes as a marker to show that in the future when something else comes in contact with the organism, does that also make the organism sick, or does it really just not have an effect on the organism at all?
And in your lab, you're studying, as you mentioned, a lot of different species. It's not just, I shouldn't say just, but if you're looking at the human genome, you know, we share many, many traits. But when you're looking at the variety of different fish or aquatic life, there's not been a lot of research up until now on the gene expression, has there?
Yeah, you know, there was a huge effort for this Human Genome Project. It was actually, as I was finishing my undergrad, they were wrapping up the Human Genome Project. But since then, we've started to use these tools for other organisms. But the problem is that the Human Genome Project, we've sequenced not just one human, but many humans now. We know what the human genome looks like. We know what a lot of the genes do. We know how it functions. But for other organisms, there is still some mystery behind what their genome looks like, what genes are there and not there compared to a human or even one fish compared to another fish. And so the goal of our center is to help people that are using these tools for environmental purposes, looking at some of these, what we say, non-model organisms or environmental model organisms, and trying to use the same tools to help put that puzzle piece together for these other organisms.
How far along are you in uncovering the secrets of the genome of the freshwater species that you might find in Lake Michigan?
So we do sequencing projects on everything from little tiny organisms to, you know, fish that are very complicated. So we've done sequencing projects on many, many species of bacteria for several of the researchers in the School of Freshwater Sciences, as well as other places, trying to identify which bacteria are present in a particular population. Are they ones that cause us to be sick? Are they indicator organisms for pollution? All the way up to sequencing a part of the sturgeon gene expression pattern, transcriptome of sturgeon, which is really complicated, has many different chromosomes, and it's very hard to put the puzzle pieces together in that particular fish species. But it's also fascinating because it's this ancient species that we care about here in Wisconsin.
Millions of years old, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it goes way, way back, and still a great part of our culture. Anybody who's been near Lake Winnebago or Lake Poygan, I think it's in February during the spearing season, knows that families have been doing that for decades. So the sturgeon is very, very important.
And that's where we got our tissues from, actually, was during that sturgeon spearing season. We worked with the Department of Natural Resources to get tissues from those fish. Folks up there were very generous in donating their tissues after they had brought their fish in for weighing and monitoring by the DNR. So very thankful to the people of Wisconsin for their help in this research.
Your students must be absolutely having a ball working in these labs, you know, knowing that they're really at the cutting edge under your direction of discovering things we don't know.
First of all, I get fantastic students in my lab. There are some great students that come from Wisconsin as well as other places that come from UWM as well as other UW schools that end up in my lab doing research. And they're doing some really exciting things. One of the things about being a graduate student is, you know, you start out by learning from the person that you're working with. But then I learned so much from my graduate students, too. They're delving right in deeply into a problem and coming up with some great answers to some of the questions that we have. So the students do such tremendous work in our school. We're really thankful to have them.
Do they ever teach you anything? Do they ever surprise you with their questions or the research that they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, the goal of a graduate student is to eventually know more about your project than your advisor does. That's definitely the goal that I have for my students. And so, yes, often by the end, they're teaching me things rather than it being the other way around, and I'm just guiding them through their research projects. So, and just very smart students that we have down at School of Freshwater Sciences. So a lot of them teach me quite a bit.
And I understand that that the genomic center that you have, you actually do work on behalf of companies as well as other universities beyond Wisconsin because of the power of the system that you have in place.
Yeah, we've done projects for local pharmaceutical companies, for other research universities, for University of Chicago, for all sorts of universities across the country doing, in particular, bacterial sequencing, but also some other fish species. We've worked with the Department of Natural Resources on some other fish projects that they've been interested in, looking at, you know, genetic diversity across populations. We recently did a walleye sequencing project in conjunction with some of those folks. We're doing a mayfly sequencing project. Mayflies are another important aquatic model species species for looking at environmental health, but they're also important fish food for a lot of the freshwater systems around here. So we've done a variety of different projects for all sorts of groups from academia to industry.
I have to ask, how did you first get interested in doing this particular research? I'd love to ask our scientists, our researchers, that question, because the answer always is different. What was it in your case that drew you to this field?
For the nanomaterial work, when I was a graduate student, there was a big article in Science about buckyballs, these fullerene that looks like a soccer ball type nanomaterial. And I was an ecology student, and one of the faculty members really liked quizzing students just to make sure they were reading science and reading enough articles in a diverse basis of science. And so he asked me if I knew what a buckyball was. And so it got me investigating more about these materials. And then I did a fellowship in Washington, D.C. in the Environmental Protection Agency. And it was through the American Association for the Advancement of Science, where they're bringing scientists into Washington, D.C. To interact with folks that do policy work. And for two different reasons. One, to bring the latest science into the government, but then also so that we would learn how decisions are made at that level. And there were several people there that were doing that had come from labs doing nanomaterial research. And so this started, you know, ruminating in my head about, you know, how do we decide how those if those things are safe and how would you make a safe nanomaterial? And so it kind of started from there. So when I got my job here, that's what I decided to look at.
So you never started as a young girl saying, I want to study nanomaterials, because they weren't invented yet.
Yes.
It's interesting how one's career or one's path unfolds or unwinds when you're in the sciences.
Exactly. Yeah, no, and I started out, playing outside and looking at critters out in nature and going on camping trips with my family. We were out in all the national parks during the summertime. We would take 6-week camping trips. My parents were school teachers, public school teachers. And so in the summertime, we would take camping trips to go see nature. And so I started out really having an ecology kind of focus and then got into – and I was initially looking at plant products and how plants create chemical defenses to protect themselves against bacteria and fungus and insects. And then moved in when I did my AAAS fellowship in D.C. into looking at man-made chemicals and how those influence some of the organisms that we care about in the environment. So same kind of questions you're asking, same kind of tools. It's just a different focus.
So are your kids as curious as you are about nature and science?
Definitely. Definitely my oldest. He says he wants to be a biologist. In his school, he was able to do some dissections, and he always likes going to the natural history museums. And anytime I find an insect or something outside that's interesting, he's always running up to check out what it is. So it's kind of encouraging that I've been able to at least influence them to not be afraid of nature and be interested in science.
And maybe that's a really good lesson for our listeners. If you have kids or grandkids, and you know, today when there is such a tendency for children to be pulled into devices, you know, a screen in front of them, as you say, just being left outside to run around and get dirty sometimes may be one of the best ways to learn.
Yeah, exactly. That definitely is. And to ask questions, you know, what is this? What, you know, how do I figure that out? It's really important.
Yeah. Well, Rebecca, wonderful sharing your stories with our listeners today. Thank you so much. And we wish you the very, very best as you continue your work at the UWM School of Freshwater Sciences, which we like to tell folks is the only school of its kind in America.
Yeah, exciting place to be. Yeah, thanks so much.
Rebecca Clapper, professor at UWM School of Freshwater Sciences, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.